All right, we come now to the next session, and actually we come to the fourth of the four major trends that lead up to the second coming of Jesus Christ. Reminding you as we rehearse those trends again, the first one was Aliyah, the Jewish people going up to Jerusalem, making their way back into the land of Israel. The second one was alignment of the nations, and that would be the time when the nations in the Middle East, mostly of them are Arab nations, some of them are Islamic nations. These nations will align themselves and they will form this coalition to go against the nation of Israel and try to destroy the Jewish people. The third of the four major trends leading to the second coming of Christ would be anticipation for peace or of peace, and we talked about how there are peace agreements on the table even as we speak. Those peace agreements having never been normalized, waiting for somebody to come along, confirm them, strengthen them, make them stronger. And the peacemaker, that coming peacemaker, the Antichrist, who will do that in preparation for the tribulation period to unfold. That event that starts the beginning of the seven-year tribulation period would be the confirmation of that peace treaty. Let me just remind you with our four major trends. They will happen between the three main events and the first two events, the rapture of the church, the next main event in God's calendar of activities, the seven-year tribulation period, followed by the return of Jesus Christ back to the earth, followed by a thousand-year millennial kingdom when he will rule and reign from the city of Jerusalem on the Temple Mount. And it's between this rapture of the church and the return of Jesus Christ and this seven-year period of time that the Antichrist will be the major player. He establishes peace. Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, we rehearse it again. Daniel 9, 27, and he, the Antichrist, shall confirm a covenant, a peace treaty with many for 1 week. And so it's that seven-year period of time, the many being the Jewish people and their enemies, the Arab Muslim world, who is going to try to destroy them. Let me make this statement to you. This is a illustration by man. I have the rapture of the church, the seven-year tribulation, the return of Christ, thousand-year millennial kingdom, and the retribution of the great white throne judgment, and then into eternity future. That is not 100% correct, because the rapture of the church does not bring in the tribulation period immediately. There are three events that have to happen after the rapture of the church before the clock starts ticking on the seven-year tribulation period. Now, we do not know how long this period of time is going to be. The Bible is not specific on that, but there are three other items that must be in place, or three events that must take place after the rapture of the church. The first one is the appearance of the ten horns that we talked about in the book of Daniel, chapter 7 and verse 7. Those ten horns, according to verse 24, yet to be a kingdom, the revived Roman Empire. Thinking about what it says over there in Revelation chapter 17 and verse 12, when these ten come to power, 1 hour with the Antichrist. So the next thing to happen after the rapture of the church here on the earth would be the revived Roman Empire. The second thing that must happen is the appearance of Antichrist. Chapter 7 of Daniel, verse 8, talks about the fact that the little horn comes out of these ten horns, diverse from the others, but he is a separate entity. And of course, we recognize, having studied this already, that little horn is the Antichrist who comes to power. The third thing that must happen is the confirmation of the peace treaty. So you have the rapture of the church, the revived Roman Empire comes into existence, the Antichrist comes out of the revived Roman Empire, he goes to the Middle East, and he confirms a peace treaty. How long will that take place? The Bible does not tell us how long. My personal opinion is it'll be a very short time, because basically everything is already in place. The stage has been set. Every actor for this to happen and be fulfilled is in place, and the curtain's about to go up on this last act of the drama. So we'll see these things, I believe, come to pass very, very quickly. Now, we'll be seeing it, of course, from the heavenlies, not from here on the earth. Those who do not know Christ as Lord and Savior will see these things happen. When the Antichrist has come on the scene, then he will make moves to allow the Jewish people to build their temple. And that is the fourth of the major trends that will unfold, the arrangements for the temple. The arrangements for the temple. We'll come back and look at Daniel. In fact, we'll look at Daniel chapter 11 and verse 45, which seems to indicate to me and to other prophecy scholars that that is how this is going to take place when the rapture has taken place and all of these other things have happened, the revived Roman Empire, the appearance of Antichrist, the confirmation of a peace treaty. And we know by our study that Ezekiel 38 verses 8 and 11 tells us that these nations will attack at a time of peace. So that seems to be in the first 6 months of the tribulation period when they have established, howbeit a pseudo peace in the Middle East. But when you go back to Daniel 9:24, it says this, "And he," the Antichrist, "shall confirm a covenant," that peace treaty, "with many," that would be the Jewish people and their neighbors who are their enemies, "with many, and in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice to cease." Now that brings another element into this seven-year period of time. That is talking about a temple. You do not have sacrifice in the city of Jerusalem where all of this is going to be headquartered without a temple. There must be a temple in place. For 2,000 years almost now, there has not been a sacrificial activity on the Temple Mount nor on the Mount of Olives where additional sacrifices would have taken place over these last 2,000 years because there is no temple in the city of Jerusalem. Now, as we approach this particular trend, we're going to become very aware of how close we are to that time when that next temple will be built on the Temple Mount in the city of Jerusalem. Before I do that, though, I thought it would be beneficial for us to look at the temples in the past. Those that will be in the future we'll be talking about as well. In fact, let me just tell you about the future. During this seven-year period of time, this tribulation period between the rapture and the return, there will be a temple. I just made that statement to you. There will be a temple on the Temple Mount in the city of Jerusalem. There will be a temple here. When you go over to the millennial kingdom, Jesus Christ will build his temple on the Temple Mount. We'll get more into that in another session. He will build a temple that will stand here on the Temple Mount. So as we look at the future, there are two temples in the future, a tribulation temple and a Messiah's temple, which will be standing on the Temple Mount in the city of Jerusalem. But let's go back, if you will, with me to the book of 1 Corinthians. Take your Bibles and go to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. And let me just tell you of the scenario that brought the first two temples into existence. The first two temples built in days past. The first one built some 3,000 years ago. The second one built about 2,200 years ago and built on the Temple Mount, the location where these next two temples will also stand as well. You go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 11, and when you get to that particular passage of Scripture, you're going to find out as you read through it, and I give you this suggestion that you might want to study sometime in your own as you think about the temple, 1 Chronicles chapter 11, 1 Chronicles chapter 11. When you go back there, you're going to see that several things did happen. And may I suggest you read from 1 Chronicles chapter 11 through 2 Chronicles chapter 5, and you will become very aware of the events that happened at that time in history. Starting in 1 Chronicles chapter 11, also a parallel passage in 2 Samuel chapter 5, we see that King David is made king over all 12 tribes of Israel. In the first 7 years of David ruling as king, he ruled only over the tribe of Judah and in a city called Hebron. That is a very sacred city to the Jewish people. It's the location of the burial site for the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, in the cave of Machpelah. It's a location where God gave that piece of real estate to a man named Caleb because of the fact that Caleb was faithful when he came as a spy along with Joshua. Those are the only two men that came out of the Egyptian bondage and made their way all the way into the promised land. And because of the faithfulness of Caleb, even in his late years in life, was given a piece of real estate around Hebron, where Eskel had a grape vineyard, where the grapes of Eskel grow, a very lovely place. I have seen grapes, by the way, out there in Hebron. I'm talking about real grapes. I'm not talking subterfuge. Grapes about that long. You could almost eat them with a knife and fork. They were so juicy. Just delicious grapes. It was a beautiful location. And that's where King David comes to power as the first king of Israel. Excuse me, the first king of Judah. And then he is going to be the king of all Israel when all the other 11 tribes come to him and ask him to join with them and take over what King Saul, the first king of Israel, had done. And so David becomes the second king of all 12 tribes of Israel. He had a 40-year reign as king, first 7 years over Judah, the last 33 years over all 12 tribes. Interesting to note, King Saul served for 40 years as king, King David for 40 years, and King Solomon served for 40 years as well. And so King David comes to power. He comes to power by capturing the Jebusite stronghold known as Jerusalem. King David realized that if he was going to be truly the king over the Jewish people, he had to have a neutral location. He could have used Hebron. He could have used other locations as well, but he chose this Jebusite stronghold, which was actually between the two tribal locations of Benjamin and Judah. And he selected this place, and he captured the city of Jerusalem, this Jebusite stronghold, and made it the political capital of the Jewish people. Now, have you heard what I've just said? This was 3,000 years ago when King David made Jerusalem the political capital of the Jewish people. That should end the discussion of how you divide or do not divide the city of Jerusalem. King David made it the political capital 3,000 years ago. In chapter 6 of 2 Samuel, and here as we continue through Chronicles, 1 Chronicles, we come to find out that King David is also going to make it the spiritual capital because he is going to go where the Ark of the Covenant was resting. You might remember that the Ark of the Covenant, when they came into the Promised Land, rested over in Shiloh. You pronounce it Shiloh here. In Hebrew, it's pronounced Shiloh. Shiloh was the location where the Ark of the Covenant rested for 350 years. That is in an area in the center part of the state known as Samaria. Judea and Samaria are, in a very terrible term, the West Bank. That is not a good term to use. If you words have meanings, remember, my dear friends, so use the proper words. West Bank. Now, if you're talking about this area, it is not the west side of Israel, it's the eastern portion of Israel where Shiloh is located. When you say the term West Bank, you're referring to the West Bank of the Jordan River. And until 1967, the Jordanians controlled that West Bank. So when you say West Bank, you're saying actually that is land that belongs to the Jordanians, not truly to Israel. The Bible refers to that land as Judea and Samaria. And indeed, when they came into the Promised Land, Joshua led them up to Shiloh, and there they built a tabernacle because that was the temporary worship center, the transportable worship center that they had been using for the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. And by the way, when you go back to the book of Exodus, chapter 25 and following, you see all of the directions that God gave Moses and thus the Jewish people for building the tabernacle, every item that would be used in the tabernacle, all the construction activities that were to take place with the tabernacle, how were you to set up a sacrificial system and do a worship system in there. That's in the book of Leviticus. So, and when you look at the tabernacle, it's an absolute pattern for the temple that King Solomon is going to build. But the tabernacle had been there, and then the Philistines come in, they take the tabernacle when God writes Ichabod over the location in Shiloh, and the glory of the Lord kind of departed from that area. So the Philistines take the Ark of the Covenant. They bring a brand new cart in. They have it ox pulled, and they take the Ark, and they keep it for about 7 years. Excuse me, 7 months. And during that 7 month period of time, they had some real physical problems. Now, an exegesis of the scripture will tell you what they had was hemorrhoids, and they could not deal with the situation. So they wanted to get rid of the Ark of the Covenant, and so they take it to Beth Shemesh, which is on the way between Jerusalem and the coastal plain area, and they put it there, and it stays there for a number of years. And in fact, the men of King David went down and looked in on it. 70,000 of them died because of the fact that they looked on the Ark of the Covenant, which they were not supposed to do. When that event happened, they took it and put it in a place called Kiriath Sharim, which is basically north of the area of Beth Shemesh, about midway point between Jerusalem and the Mediterranean coast. They left it there for about 120 years. Now we come to King David. He is king of all of 12 tribes. He's moved into Jerusalem. He's captured the city. He made it the political capital of the Jewish people. He wants to make it the spiritual capital. And so he decides he's going to go get the Ark of the Covenant there in Kiriath Sharim, and he's going to bring the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem. He builds him a brand new cart, gets an ox to pull the cart, goes with all of his men over to Kiriath Sharim, about 15 miles to the west of Jerusalem, puts the Ark on the cart, starts bringing it back to Jerusalem. The cart hits a bump in the road. The Ark starts to slide off the cart. Uzzah reaches up and stops it. He dies on the spot because he touched it. And then all of a sudden, King David realized, well, I'm doing the right thing, but I'm doing it in the wrong way. What he was doing was copying the world. He looked at the Philistines. He said, hey, they moved that on a brand new cart pulled by an ox. Isn't that the way you're supposed to move the Ark of the Covenant from location to location? He decided to go back to Jerusalem and read the manual. When all else fails, read the manual. And the manual says you have four Levites who would hoist the Ark of the Covenant up on the shittim poles covered with gold that go through the rings on the sides of the Ark of the Covenant, a rectangular box. So, oh! And 3 months later, he goes back to Kiriath Sharim with the four Levites. They hoist the Ark of the Covenant up on their shoulders, and King David and all of his people dance all the way to Jerusalem, and they bring it into this political capital. David has prepared a tabernacle in the city of Jerusalem. This is 2 Samuel. It's also found here in the 1 Corinthian passages as well. They come into Jerusalem, and Jerusalem becomes the spiritual capital of the Jewish people, the spiritual capital of the Jewish people. Well, David has a desire to be able to build a place, a permanent dwelling place for this ark. Go to the 17th chapter of 1 Chronicles. 17th chapter of 1 Chronicles. Now it came to pass, as David sat in his house, that David said to Nathan the prophet, lo, I dwell in a house of cedars, but the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord remaineth under curtains. In other words, it's in the tabernacle in this place. I want to have a permanent dwelling place. I am desirous of building a permanent dwelling place for the Ark of the Covenant and a permanent worship center for the Lord. Well, you know the story. Nathan had to tell him. He had to be the one, the prophet, to tell him he's not going to be able to build it. His son would build it, and one of his sons would live on it in the future. And, of course, that is the Davidic covenant. That would be 2 Samuel chapter 7, the Davidic covenant, a promise of that temple one day to be built. The first installment of that promise of the Davidic covenant is going to take place when King Solomon, after the death of his father, King David, does build that that place to house the ark and have a permanent worship center. By the way, may I suggest to you that King David, though upset about not being able to build the temple, would have a responsibility, he felt, to gather all the manpower that were going to build this temple, put together all the materials that would be used in building the temple, and raise all the monies that would be used to build this magnificent building. And that's exactly what we see. In fact, he was going to pay personally himself for the spot where the temple would go up. Go over here to the 21st chapter of the book of 1 Chronicles. Verse 18, and when the angel of the Lord, and I believe that when you see that phrase, when the angel of the Lord is mentioned, you're talking about a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ, then the angel of the Lord commanded Gad to say to David that David should go up and set up an altar unto the Lord in the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. Ornan the Jebusite had purchased what we know as Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah, at the peak of it, he had his threshing floor. And David wanted to go up there, told by the angel of the Lord, a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ, to go up there and put an altar up and offer sacrifice. So long story short, you can read the passage if you'd like to. He goes up there, he offers to buy the threshing floor from Ornan the Jebusite. Ornan, having seen the angel as well, said, hey, I'll give you this threshing floor. And King David said, no way am I going to allow you to give me the threshing floor. Look here in verse 24. And King David said to Ornan, nay, but I will verily pay it for the full price, for I will not take that which is thine for the Lord, nor offer burnt offerings without cost. So David gave Ornan in that place 600 shekels of gold by weight, and the present price of gold, that would be somewhere about $15,000 that he paid for the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. Did you hear what I just said? King David purchased the spot where the temple was going to stand. It is the most sacred piece of real estate in all of creation. It's the location for the creation of Adam and Eve. And King David paid cash money for it. The title deed is the Word of God. Same thing, by the way, happened for Machpelah's cave. Abraham wanted a place to bury Sarah. He paid cash money for Machpelah cave in Hebron, the second most sacred piece of real estate in all of the Jewish world. Both of these pieces of real estate today, not under control of the Jewish people technically, they have no access to either one of them unless the Muslim world allows them to have it, and they pay cash money. King David buying the threshing floor for Ornan the Jebusite. Well, we could spend much more time, but go to 2 Chronicles, if you will, chapter 3, 2 Chronicles, chapter 3. Go there with me and quickly look at Solomon, who moves now to build the temple. The first installment of the Davidic covenant is fulfilled by the son of King David building the temple. Then Solomon began to build the house of the Lord at Jerusalem in Mount Moriah, where the Lord appeared unto David his father in the place that David had prepared in the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. If you want to read some exciting material, continue to read up to about the 5th or 6th chapter of 2 Chronicles. It'll bless your heart. It says not only here in 2 Chronicles, but in 1 Kings chapter 8, for example, of 1 Kings, that when the Levites went down to get the Ark of the Covenant out of the tabernacle in the city of David and bring it up to the mountain, Mount Moriah, and there to build that temple, while that was all going on, as they brought the temple into the Holy of Holies, the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. They were incapable of being able to really even worship. What's going on? Look at here, 1 Chronicles chapter 5, verse 14. So that the priest could not stand to minister by reason of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord had filled the house of the Lord when they brought that ark into this first temple. Now that's the first temple. The first temple. Go to the second temple with me, if you will. The second temple. Go to the book of 2 Chronicles chapter 36. 2 Chronicles chapter 36. By the way, on your way over there, stop by 2 Chronicles chapter 35 just a moment, and let me show you where the Ark of the Covenant is. The Ark of the Covenant has never been to Jerusalem, never will go to Jerusalem. Never will go to Ethiopia. It's always been in Jerusalem. In 2 Chronicles chapter 35, Josiah is the king, and he decides to move the ark out of the Holy of Holies into the hiding place that King Solomon had prepared. Verse 3, 2 Chronicles 35. And he said unto the Levites that taught all of Israel, which were holy unto the Lord, put the holy ark in the house. That word is bayith in Hebrew, B-A-Y-I-T-H, meaning house, but it also means secret, secluded hiding place. Put the holy ark in the secret, secluded hiding place, which Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, did build. And so they placed that Ark of the Covenant underneath what we know today as the Dome of the Rock. The Ark of the Covenant has been there now for more than 2,600 years. It was not in the temple. When they came back, they did not put it in the second temple. When they came back out of the Babylonian captivity, it was not in the temple in the times of Jesus Christ. If you've ever been inside the Dome of the Rock, you can see where the ark would have rested. There's a rectangular impression there in that stone. And right beside it, they have drilled a hole, and symbolically, the high priest would go into the Holy of Holies, and instead of pouring the blood on the mercy seat, which is the Ark of the Covenant, they would pour it through that hole and simply pour the blood on the mercy seat on Yom Kippur every time they would come together. In fact, a very interesting statement in the book of Acts chapter 6 and verse 7, where it says a multitude of priests turned to Jesus Christ early on in the church history. You know, that's a very amazing verse to me. I don't know what a multitude. They need 28,000 priests to operate the temple. What's a multitude? It's not defined. Let's say half of them, 14,000, turned to Jesus Christ. Why did they turn? Let me tell you why I think they turned. When that Ark of the Covenant was in that Holy of Holies, during the other periods of history, they would know the high priest would go in there to offer the sacrifice. But since the Ark of the Covenant was not in there, and they didn't know that, they thought the high priest was going in to pour the blood on the mercy seat. But when that veil of the temple ripped from top to bottom on the day Christ was crucified, they had access to look into the Holy of Holies, and that ark was not in there. So they started to say, hey, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Those high priests have been lying to us. What is this all about? And they started to look at every aspect of the temple, the building itself, all the implements in the temple, every sacrificial activity, every worship activity, and they recognized that it was pointing to the man who claimed to be the Messiah. Because every aspect of the temple, every aspect of it, points to Jesus Christ the Messiah. I'll tell you as we get closer to another session how we're talking about that. So now look what happens. The temple is destroyed. 2 Chronicles chapter 36. Nebuchadnezzar comes in, destroys the temple. Verse 7. Nebuchadnezzar also carried off the vessels of the house of the Lord to Babylon and put them in his temple in Babylon. And verse 18, and all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king and of his princes, all of these he brought into Babylon. Verse 19, and they burned the house of God. So that's the first temple, Solomon's temple being destroyed. Now we move to Ezra chapter 1. Ezra chapter 1, this is 70 years after 2 Chronicles chapter 35. They're in that time of judgment upon the Jewish people because they did not keep the sabbaticals for the land, and they're out of the land. But in Isaiah chapter 44, God had given a prophecy to Isaiah to write down, and he specifically named an individual who would allow the Jews to go back and build another temple. Verse 2, thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord God of heaven hath given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he hath charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is Judah. He selects Zerubbabel and Joshua, one a political leader, the other a spiritual leader. Chapter 2 tells us of the 49,897 Jews, actually to be precise, who go back into Jerusalem to build the temple. When they get there, they lollygag, that's a good old southern word, they lollygag, they start getting more concerned about building their own houses. When you come to the book of Ezra chapter 5, that's the place where you put in the two books, Haggai and Zechariah. Then the prophets, Haggai, the prophet, and Zechariah, the prophet prophesied unto the Jews that were in Judea and Jerusalem, and they basically were saying, build the temple. You've been out of the Babylonian captivity. They came out in 539 B.C. Now we're at a point 15 years, 20 years later. Actually, it's going to take them 25 years in 515 B.C. before they get that temple erected, because they were concerned about their own houses where they were going to, their own personal little temples. Zechariah and Haggai, this is where you read those two prophetic books. Zechariah, a young man who was a priest, by the way, never had served in a temple because he studied his priestly duties for the 30 years that he had to do that while he was in the captivity. But he was a very important prophet and used of God to exhort the Jewish people to build their temple. He was young, suave, debonair, like Rob Congdon. But the other guy was Haggai. Man, he was a crusty old man. You know, Zechariah saved with all the pretty words, and old Haggai, he was kind of like me. You know, do it right now. That's the way I counsel people. I don't have a whole lot of people I counsel, but the word says this, do it. That's the way old Haggai said, build that temple. Well, they built the temple, man. They were scared to death. They built the temple, chapter 6. Look what it says in chapter 6, verse 15. And this house was finished on the third day of the month of Adar, which is in the sixth year of the reign of Darius the king, and the children of Israel, the priests and the Levites and the rest of the children of the captivity, kept the dedication of this house of God with joy. And they offered at the dedication of this house of God 100 bullocks, 200 rams, 400 lambs, and for a sin offering for all of Israel, 12 he-goats according to the number of the tribes of Israel. They have a dedicatory service for this temple. It's 515 B.C. It's 25 years after they came back from Babylon. They finally get the temple built. And then you go to the next chapter, chapter 7. That's when Ezra leaves Babylon. He leaves Babylon. He doesn't come back with them. He leaves Babylon and comes back to restore the temple activities and institute all of those things that were going to take place. Well, that's the second temple. By the way, we refer to it by another name when we come to the New Testament. We refer to that temple, the second temple. It's the same temple. It's called Herod's Temple. Herod's Temple. So the temple Zerubbabel built is the same as Herod's Temple. Go to John just a second, if you will. John chapter 2. The Gospel of John and chapter 2. A very interesting statement made by John. John chapter 2 and verse 22. Jesus had talked about, you destroy this temple and in 3 days I'll raise it up. And they thought he was talking about the literal temple, Herod's temple. Verse 21 says, but he spake of the temple of his body. When therefore he was risen from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this unto them, and they believed the scriptures and the word which Jesus had said. And so they believed actually what was being said. But up in verse 20, notice what it says. When he first said that, these Jews said, hey, 46 years was this temple in building, and wilt thou rear it down and rear it up in 3 days? Well, he was talking about his body, as I just read to you. But Herod spent 46 years with the manpower of thousands, tens of thousands of men that would build this magnificent building, the most beautiful building that people who came there said. The rabbi said, if you've never seen Herod's temple, you've never seen a beautiful building. General Titus of the Roman army, when he came across the Kidron Valley to destroy it, said, I've seen every beautiful building in the world. This is the most beautiful. And then he had his men tear it apart piece by piece. So we have the first temple and the second temple. There is a third temple, the tribulation temple, that is yet to come, this third temple. We're going to be spending some time in our next session looking at that. But as we conclude this class period, I want you just to watch a video that I did for Day of Discovery, Martin Hahn and myself, and it's going to give you a glimpse into the potential temple that Jesus Christ will build. That's, I think, potentially very close at hand. So if you will, give your attention to the screen and the video, and we'll conclude this class session with this video.
Because of the steep uphill,
they're just
letting the car cool down.
Yeah. And the stone, where's it going?
That far from here.
Okay.
Okay, at the other end of the uphill climb, they have a factory. And there the stones are going to be cut up into size, some used for building, some gravel, some being made into cement.
Today in Israel, the building code of Jerusalem requires all new buildings to be built or at least faced with limestone. In this land of the Bible, limestone has always been a building material of choice. Jerusalem's western wall stands as a monument to ancient stonemasons who quarried massive blocks of limestone to form a retaining wall for Israel's sacred Temple Mount. It was here in September of 1996 that an international controversy broke out when Jewish officials opened a northern exit to an underground tunnel which allowed access to the length of the Western Wall. Muslim caretakers of the Al-Aqsa Mosque argued that these excavations threatened the stability of their holy sites. Israeli officials claimed their work was in the opposite direction of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They said their intent was to make it possible for more visitors to descend into the ancient world of first century Israel and to a place considered sacred by many religious people.
Jim, the stones of this retaining wall are huge.
They really are.
Remind me of that truck we saw broken down the other day. Can you imagine if it was hauling one of these things?
What, this stone you have your hand on, in fact. Keep your hand right there. Stand right there just a moment. Let me show you. This one particular stone is larger than all the stones on that truck put together. Now, this one stone is from where you are to right here, over 50 feet, weighing over 600 tons.
How did they move it?
I tell you, one way they did not move it, it was with that truck that we saw. In fact, this stone is probably larger than that entire truck. Here's what I want to show you, though. This is Warren's Gate. It was one of four entrances to the Temple Mount when the temple stood here in the time of Jesus Christ. In 1982, two rabbis, Rabbi Yehuda Getz, who was the chief rabbi of the Western Wall, and Rabbi Shlomo Gorin, he was the first rabbi at the Western Wall in June of 67, and later became the chief rabbi of the State of Israel. They told me personally that they went through this area, which has now been stoned in, they went through this area underneath the Temple Mount, and they saw the Ark of the Covenant. Now, the Bible does say that in one period of time, the Ark of the Covenant was placed under the Temple Mount, and many of the Jewish extra-biblical writings talk about that as well.
Yeah, maybe.
I want to show you up here, though, the most holy spot in this Western Wall Tunnel. It's the location closest to where the Holy of Holies was. As you know, the Holy of Holies was that room in the temple where the most sacred piece of furniture, the Ark of the Covenant, was located. It was also the place where the glory of the Lord dwelt.
People today have put prayer requests in the rock and the cracks here. It's important for us to realize that our interest in this wall, this retaining wall near to the original site of the Holy of Holies, is not only because of what was there in the past, but because there is today in Jerusalem, in Israel, a growing anticipation and expectation that the temple that once stood here will be rebuilt again.
One prays for it and one hopes for it. In that sense, there is a very strong feeling. It's in our prayers every day. We await the temple to return. But it's not something one relates to that directly on a day-to-day basis.
The God of Israel promised to meet with his people at a temple built on the place of his choosing.
As a Jew, like, it's something that you have to think about, you know? It's just part of, like Jewish life. Like, you know, you learn in the Torah, like in the Bible, that like eventually God will, you know, will be out of this exile that we're in now, and God will rebuild the third temple.
Before its destruction, the Temple of Israel formed a spiritual and cultural focal point for the whole nation.
I'm not an extremely religious Orthodox Jew, but yeah, it is something that I think about a lot. I fight for Israel. I volunteered over here for the army, and I've been serving in the Golani Brigade up in the north of Israel. And definitely, it's something that we would love to see, but I don't think at this point in time it might be a realistic vision. something maybe when the Messiah comes, that we're hoping that there will be a third temple.
Historically, Israel's temples have been a place where the whole nation offered prayers and sacrifices for their personal and national sins.
Well, I think about it all the time. I mean, Chris, I'm a Kohen, you know, that's a priest, and, you know, I'm probably going to serve there when it's built.
The prophets of Israel foresaw a temple which would, in the last days, again signal God's presence and blessing upon his people.
At my yeshiva, we're located on a view in the old city overlooking it, and it's something when I look over there, and I have a mental picture of which way it's going to look, and you know what it's going to be like going on there, and you know seeing it for the first time, or even building it. If I'm here when that happens, you know, if I'm able to take part in like building it or going there for the first time.
I like the third temple. I want it to be built, and I want all the Jewish people from all around the world to come and see it and have a good prayer in it.
A temple of the future is thought by many to be the place from which Israel's Messiah will bring peace and renewal to the whole world.
Since the destruction of the temple in AD 70 by the Romans, the Jewish people have not had a central sanctuary, a place of sacrifice, a place to deal with the need to be cleansed from their sins. And that is a problem for many Jewish people. And that's one of the reasons why we believe that the temple will be rebuilt to deal with these issues that have not yet been resolved, the issue of the need for cleansing from sin.
In giving a temple, God is giving a visible symbol of His presence in the midst of His people. God wanted a reminder to Israel of His love, His protection, His covenant, His plan for them. The temple was that visible reminder. In giving a new temple, God is reminding Israel that He has a place for them again. He's going to fulfill His promises to them again in the future.
Well, Israel has always had a special place of worship. After the Exodus, within a year of the Exodus, they set up the tabernacle at Mount Sinai. And God gave specific directions about the tabernacle and its structure and its various rooms and its purposes. And when they were camping in the wilderness, they carried that tabernacle with them. They brought it with them into the land of Israel when they conquered the Holy Land. And they set up the tabernacle in the land of Israel. After the tabernacle had been destroyed, probably by the Philistine at Shiloh, eventually the temple replaced it in Jerusalem. And the story of David purchasing the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite and Solomon eventually building the temple, it's a great story in the scripture. But once again, we see there is a central place for worship for God's people. And in this particular case, it is in Jerusalem, not under every tree or on every hill, but in Jerusalem, so that God's reputation could be displayed in that place.
This section of the Old City is the Jewish Quarter, and mostly populated by those who have a real desire to be close to where the temple stood in the time of Herod the Great, but also they anticipate a coming temple that will stand on the Temple Mount here in the city of Jerusalem. Many of those who are studying priestly duties to operate that coming temple live here in the Jewish Quarter. In fact, in the apartment right above this little marketplace, Rabbi Nachman Kahana called together a group of religious Jewish men, and they started studying the activities to build that coming temple. I need to get a paper. Hello. Jerusalem Post, please. As a journalist here in the city of Jerusalem, I need to be able to check my undisclosed sources. But in reality, the Jerusalem Post does provide information about this coming temple that will one day stand here in the city of Jerusalem.
Not since 70 AD, when Roman armies leveled the Temple of Israel, has a Jewish house of worship stood on the original site of Solomon's temple. Instead, since the 7th century, a Muslim shrine called the Dome of the Rock has occupied Israel's most holy place. In spite of this golden dome, A devout segment of Jewish believers are making plans for a temple and future sacrifices that they hope will usher in the long-awaited Messianic age. Here in Jerusalem's Jewish quarter, we find Treasures of the Temple. This teaching center is an extension of the Temple Institute. It was formed to promote awareness of a coming temple and to develop implements needed for future temple service. Here the story is told of Jewish men who are even now being trained for future priestly duties. Also displayed are replicas of biblical harps, which the Harari harp makers hope will be used in the music of a future temple.
Micka, the Temple Institute has been on the cutting edge in preparations to build the next temple, the third temple. Have they commissioned you to make these biblical harps?
Basically, they came to us when they wanted harps made that would be for the temple. And they checked out our instruments and they checked us out and they asked us to do it. So several years ago, we began to make harps for them.
Are you the only harp makers in the state of Israel?
Yeah, we're the only harp makers here in 2,000 years.
The implements, the instruments to be used in the worship service and the sacrificial activities at that temple have been made and are in storage. There are priests in the city of Jerusalem studying their duties to operate the temple. And now here at the harp factory, for the first time in 2,000 years, they're making the biblical harps that will be used when the temple stands in full operations on the Temple Mount in the city of Jerusalem.
The best description of this future temple is found in the latter part of the book of Ezekiel. Chapters 40 through 48, Ezekiel describes a new life for the nation Israel. The first part of that section, Ezekiel describes this temple. Its dimensions are larger than any other temple ever built. He pictures first the layout of the temple in such detail that you could actually construct it. Then he describes the return of the glory of the Lord and the glory of the Lord filling that temple. And then he describes the new service of worship for God.
One of the most fascinating prophecies that I find in the Bible is the prophecy of a future temple. And I find these prophecies featured in Ezekiel. Ezekiel chapter 40 through 48 really cover the period of Israel's future. And it's exciting to see that Ezekiel describes a temple in the future. And he gives a very accurate description of a temple with many elements that can be actually measured. And he describes measurements for this temple. And the measurements are so precise that a model of this temple can be and has been constructed.
In the New Testament, Jesus Christ confirmed that indeed there will be a temple standing here in the city of Jerusalem. But the prophet Ezekiel, in seven chapters of his prophecy, gives information that this future temple is going to be different than the previous ones that stood here on the Temple Mount.
We'll continue that video and we'll look at the additional information in the next class that we have on the temple. Suffice to say, I said there are two temples in the future. That passage in Ezekiel, those seven chapters, Ezekiel 40 to 46, 202 verses of minutely detailed information about Messiah's temple. But before Messiah's temple, a tribulation temple. And when we come together for our next class, we'll study about that temple and how close it is to being built.